He didn't want alibis, he used to say. Moses knew exactly what he wanted each of his men to do, and he was impatient when they had difficulty grasping that fact. William H. Lapham, a young engineer from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, was also assigned to observe and report on meetings of the Nassau County Board of Supervisors. I came back from the first meeting, and in giving him my report, I generalized, Lapham recalls. He corrected me, but I guess I didn't get it, and the second time I started to generalize again. Well, he didn't let me get very far. His palm came down on that table of Belmont's, and he jumped up and he paced around that table, and he told me he wanted facts, no assumptions. All he wanted from me was what had happened at that meeting. He'd draw his own conclusions. And he let me know right there and then that if I wouldn't do it that way, he'd have to find another engineer. And, Lapham adds, Moses wasn't really angry at him on that occasion. Lapham, an athlete and outdoorsman, is a tall, rangy man with huge shoulders and an easy, friendly grin. But the grin fades when he says, I won't talk about what he's like when he's really angry. Another technique was the silent treatment. All of a sudden, a staffer recalls, you just wouldn't be called in to sit at the conferences anymore. He wouldn't talk to you if he passed you in the hall, and then one day, you'd just be gone. The men who stayed didn't resent Moses' methods. If he drove other men hard, says Junkerman, he drove himself harder. He was supervising a dozen non-park projects for Smith, of course, and he was constantly commuting to Albany, a 4-hour train trip away. During legislative sessions, he tried to make his trips on Mondays because the legislature convened each week on Monday evening, and it was then that GOP strategy became apparent, and the governor liked to have his advisors gathered in the executive chamber ready to counter it, so that he could get in a full day's work in Albany before the executive chamber session. Moses left his New York apartment at 6 a.m. to catch the early train to the Capitol and avoid a car trip made torturous by the lack of a through road. When the session broke up, usually well after the last train back had left at midnight, Moses would ask Smith for the use of a state car and chauffeur. He had a lot of work to do back on Long Island, he'd say. If he drove back at once, he'd be able to start in the morning. Albany wasn't the only duty that pulled Moses from Long Island. To supervise the State Council of Parks, he had to spend at least part of 3 days a week in New York City. To inspect the Regional Commission's upstate projects, he was constantly being driven to or from Watkins Glen or Chittenango Falls or Letchworth Gorge. But when his car pulled up in front of the Belmont Mansion, Moses never seemed tired. Charging into Arthur Howland's office, he would slam the door behind him and listen to the chief engineer's problems. Then, one by one, he would call in the other top commission officials and, behind the closed door, listen to theirs. Then the door would fly open, and he would charge out into the dining room and sit down at the huge table and begin solving the problems. Junkerman recalls, he might have been working in New York and not arrive out at Belmont until 3 o'clock in the afternoon, but then he would work from 3 until 10 o'clock or midnight. Another day, I might get there at 9 o'clock in the morning, and he'd already be there working at the big table. Then I'd go out on some errand and wouldn't get back until supper time, and he'd still be sitting there. And he'd still be sitting there at midnight. Saturdays were no different. Hours didn't mean anything to him, Lapham says. Days of the week didn't mean anything to him. You worked when there was work to be done. That was all. And there was always work to be done. Since none of the staffers dared leave the mansion until Moses left, they longed for him to get a telephone call from Mary, which usually got him away from the big table and back to his house in Babylon. Sometimes, Junkerman recalls, Ray McNulty would slip out and call her and put her up to calling. One Saturday night, repeated telephone calls from Mary failed to bring Bob home, and at 10 o'clock she showed up at the mansion. Striding into the conference room, she just took him by the ear in a very nice but firm way and pulled him to his feet, Junkerman recalls. He just laughed and went along, and then we could all go home. Going home did not, however, necessarily mean a cessation of work for Moses. Giving Howland a key to his Babylon house on Thompson Avenue, he told the chief engineer to stop by every morning on his way to the mansion. Almost invariably, when Howland arrived at about 7:30 a.m., there would be waiting for him on the flat-topped bottom post of the banister a large manila envelope crammed with notes, memos, and handwritten letters ready to be typed and mailed, an envelope full of testimony to what Moses had been doing during the night while his men slept. He tried to keep Sundays free for his family, teaching Jane and Barbara to swim or sail, taking them for picnics, telling them stories. But often the girls would notice that their father had disappeared. When that happened, they knew he was out on the big screened porch on the side of the house, scribbling furiously on a yellow legal pad. And most of the family picnics were held in one of his parks. "Hell," one of the men working under him remembers, "any Sunday at all, you could expect to look around and see the boss and his wife and kids, and he'd be making notes as he walked along if he saw something he didn't like. So you figured if he was working, why shouldn't you be?" There were other reasons, too, why the men who stayed didn't resent the driving. "It was exciting working for Moses," one of the commission staffers recalls. "He made you feel you were a part of something big. It was almost like a war. It was you fighting for the people against those rich estate owners and those reactionary legislators. And it was exciting just being around him. He was dynamic, a big guy with a booming laugh. He dominated that scene in the mansion. He would sit there with people running back and forth around him, and he would be banging his hand down on that big table and giving orders, and when he gave orders, things happened. Howland would go hurrying out of the room, and 25 draftsmen would hurry to their tables and start drawing, or surveyors would jump into their cars and head out on the road." And men recalled, incongruous as it might seem to use the word fun in connection with unremitting work, it was, nevertheless, fun to work for Bob Moses. "There was a very informal atmosphere in the mansion," one engineer says. "Everyone worked in their shirt sleeves. My recollection of Moses is of him sitting with his tie pulled down and over to one side, sleeves rolled up, and there was always a lot of joking going on. And the joking," the engineer says, "went both ways. You weren't afraid to kid him." He turned the commission staff into a big family. If he couldn't get home to his wife and children as much as he would have liked, he brought them to his work. Commission staffers became accustomed to seeing Barbara and Jane playing on the playground equipment that Moses had brought from all over the United States and set up on the mansion's lawn so that he could test it. Jane was much more adventurous than her quiet, shy, dark-haired sister, who eyed the equipment with distrust, and the staffers laughed to watch the little blonde tomboy scramble around on the top bars of the jungle gyms and swing higher and higher on the swings. Mary was always around. She was the hostess at the little luncheons that Moses would have catered at the mansion if a politician or key landowner was visiting. She was a pleasant, easy friend to the young men working for her husband, and a confidant, a sympathetic shoulder for their wives to cry on, who remember her with real affection. Moses was always consulting her. Says Mrs. Harold Morse, a friend, "Bob used to say that the only decisions he made that were mistakes were the decisions he had neglected to talk over with Mary first." He and Mary organized outings and insisted that Howland, Latham, Shapiro, McNulty, and Junkerman, and Tom McWinney, with whom Moses was getting along famously, bring their wives and children along. The outings were very informal, fishing trips on the commission motor launch Apache or clam bakes, and they were fun. Recalls McWinney's daughter, Dolly, 28 at the time, "We used to go over to Fire Island for the whole weekend. There was an old frame building at the Coast Guard station there, and we'd sleep in it on cots, all the men in one room and the women and kids in another. There weren't any stores on Fire Island, so we'd bring most of our food along and go trolling from the Apache or clamming for the rest. While the women were cleaning the catch, the men would dig a great hole in the sand, cover its bottom with logs, and light them for the clam bake. There would be bonfires on the beach at night, and singing. Moses set the tone. His clothes were a constant source of merriment. His pants were khakis faded white, or corduroys, only some of whose holes had been patched. Possibly because his hairline was beginning to recede, he wore, no matter what the weather, a hat. The same hat. "Robert," Mary would say, "take off that hat." Everyone would laugh. It was one of those fedoras with a big brim, and it was completely shapeless and all stained, Dolly McQuinney recalls. It was the funniest hat you ever saw, and Bob would never take it off, except when he went swimming. He helped arrange the logs for the clam bake, helped clean up afterward, helped with the children. Because Charlie Smizik, the Apache skipper, would be away from home all weekend, Moses insisted that Charlie's wife May come along, and he went out of his way to make the Smiziks feel at home. There was no side to Bob Moses at all then, an acquaintance says. The only thing that set him apart was his swimming. Hurling himself through the first of the big Atlantic rollers, he would appear on the far side of its tumult, swimming, and head straight out into the Atlantic, far beyond where even outdoorsman Latham would dare to go. Of all the reasons why Moses' men didn't resent his driving, the one most frequently mentioned in their reminiscences is that he brought out the best in them. One of Junkerman's duties was to work with Long Island villages on zoning restrictions on the land adjoining the Southern State Parkway. Mr. Moses wanted 500 feet on either side of the parkway zoned in the highest residential classifications, Junkerman recalls, and he didn't want any water tanks or other unsightly structures near them either. Zoning was a relatively new thing. Hardly a village on Long Island had a zoning ordinance. I had to draw up a lot of what we wanted myself. Then Mr. Moses would have to speak to officials in the municipality and get them to draft overall zoning ordinances in which our stuff could be incorporated. I'd have to work with the local council every step of the way. And then, after the ordinances were adopted, I'd have to work with the local zoning board when people tried to break the restrictions. And I found that at every step of the way, Mr. Moses had ideas that started me thinking along whole new lines. Constantly, Moses was encouraging his architects and engineers to use their imagination, to make their designs different from and better than any similar designs done before. When the men designing a drawbridge for the Jones Beach Causeway submitted their first design, he said, "I know you can do drawbridges. Can you do beautiful drawbridges?" In their second design, the bridge operators' quarters were no longer the standard ugly shacks, but turrets faced with stone worked with the silhouettes of sailing ships. Gilmore Clark thought he had surpassed himself in the design of bridges for the Bronx River Parkway, but he found Moses had some new standards. He wanted variety, Moses told him. Not only were the bridges to be designed to harmonize with the landscape, and not only were they to be stone-faced, but every bridge on every parkway on Long Island, all 100 of them, was going to be different from every other bridge. Engineers assigned to design guardrails and light poles for the parkways expended tremendous effort making the standard iron poles graceful. But iron wouldn't blend in with a rustic setting, Moses said. Guardrails and light poles would have to be made of wood. But it had been proven that no form of wooden guardrails would resist the impact of a speeding car, the engineers said. Moses sent them back to ponder the problem again, and this time one thought of drilling holes in wooden rails and inserting strong steel cable. And now all the rails on all the parkways could be wood. As always, it was on Jones Beach that Moses' imagination focused. He thought himself of many little touches to make people feel happy and relaxed there. The dunes, he said one day, were a natural protective wall for an archery range, so archery should be included as one of the sports offered at the beach. And why just have ordinary targets, he said. Why not let kids shooting arrows feel they were really in the Middle Ages, when archers stormed castles? Let some of the targets be cutouts in the shape of enemy bowmen crouching behind castle turrets. Why just have signs directing people to various activities, he asked. Why not decorate the signs with ironwork showing the activities and showing them in humorous fashion? One day, a designer rather hesitantly showed him a design for the directional signs to the men's rooms. The design was the silhouette of a man, obviously in a desperate hurry, rushing to a bathroom so fast that the little boy he was dragging behind had his feet pulled off the ground. It was, of course, a little daring, the designer began. Daring, Moses said. He wanted his designers to be daring. This was a great design, he said. It would be used. Mr. Moses was no lawyer, but he had a great knowledge and grasp of the law, Junkman would say. He was not an engineer, but he had a great knowledge of engineering. He knew politics. He knew statesmanship. He was an altogether brilliant man. If you were working with him, you just had to learn from him, if only through osmosis. One of the commission's engineers rhapsodizes, I don't think there was a man who came into daily contact with him who wasn't inspired to do better work than he had thought he was capable of doing. If the political difficulties involved in creating a park on Jones Beach were enormous, the physical difficulties were of a size to match. Building on a barrier beach proved to be a very different proposition from building on the mainland. Commission engineers found themselves faced with a succession of problems engineers never encountered on mainland jobs. Cleveland Rogers, Moses' first biographer, was to write that sometimes it seemed as if nature herself had joined forces with the skeptics and obstructionists who had fought Moses all the way from Albany to the beach. But Moses refused to let nature stand in his way. None of Moses' engineers had expected work on the barrier beach to continue in winter because drifting ice packs that kept boats off the Great South Bay for days at a time could maroon anyone caught on the strand. But with Smith's time as governor running out, winters could not be wasted. Moses told the engineers taking surveys for the causeway to cache emergency supplies of food in a shack on the beach and keep working. Even on mornings when wind was whipping the bay into waves and ice was coating the piers, Sid Shapiro led his hip-booted surveyors into boats for the trip across. One day, while they were on the strand, ice packs closed the bay. It stayed closed for 10 days. All the cached food ran out except pancake batter, and the surveyors lived on pancakes. For the rest of his life, Sid Shapiro would never be able to stomach another pancake. But when the ice cleared and the surveyors returned to Babylon, Shapiro could tell Moses, who was standing on the dock waiting for a report, that 10 days more work had been completed. The completed surveys contained the worst of news. The mean level of the existing barrier beach, Moses was told, was only 2 feet above mean sea level. During storms, the ocean rose 6, 7, or even 8 feet and covered the strand almost completely. This did not matter as far as the portion of the beach that was to be a beach was concerned, but the portion that was to hold Moses' buildings and parking lots and parkway would have to be built up to a mean height of 14 feet. If they were not to be submerged in every storm, and if he wanted a road 17 miles long along it, it would have to be built up to that height for 17 miles. The job could be done, of course. Floating dredges, huge pumps mounted on barges, could suck up hydraulic fill, which would become sand when dry, from the bay bottom, and pipelines could spill it out over the strand. But approximately 40 million cubic yards of fill would be required. The job would take months, and it would be expensive. Even Smith quailed at this, and Moses had to talk fast and hard to persuade the governor to go along. But he did persuade him, and the largest floating dredges in the United States were brought to the bay as soon as spring cleared the ice off it in 1927. The job could not be completed by the time ice set in again in the winter, but Moses refused to let the dredges leave. Their crews could live on them, he said, and all through the winter of 1927-28, they did, and the pumps kept working. Night after night, Shapiro recalls, they kept working to midnight. When the sand from the bay bottom was spread on the barrier beach, it proved to be the worst problem of all. It was beautiful to look at, dazzling white and fine-grained, but the fineness meant that when it dried, it blew. Even the lightest breeze stirred it into the air in swirls so thick that the strand looked like a desert during a violent sandstorm. "It was always blowing in your face when you worked," Shapiro remembers. "When it got bad, it would fill your eyes, your ears, and your nose as fast as you could clean them out. You'd be choking and coughing. You'd be talking to somebody not 3 feet away, and an especially violent gust would come, and you couldn't even see him anymore. You couldn't even see the hand in front of your face." During the day, workmen would dig an excavation. At night, the sand would fill it in, so completely that the workmen couldn't even find its edges. One workman who left his car with its rear end turned into the wind for a few days came back to find the numerals and all other color completely erased from its rear license plate. Moses dispatched landscape architects to other Long Island beaches to find out why the sand on older, natural dunes was more stable. They reported that it was because of the presence on these dunes of a form of beach grass, Ammophila arenaria, whose roots, seeking water in the dry sand, spread horizontally rather than vertically, and thus held sand around it in place. But to be effective, they reported, the grass had to be planted thickly. Hundreds of thousands, even millions of clumps would be required to hold down the new dunes on Jones Beach, and it could be planted only by hand. In the summer of 1928, on the desolate sandbar on the edge of the ocean, amid half-completed building skeletons that looked like ancient ruins, was a panorama out of the dynasties of the pharaohs. Hundreds, thousands of men spread out over miles of sand, kneeling on the ground, digging little holes, and planting in them tiny bundles of grass. The peculiarities of man seemed sometimes to join with those of nature to thwart Moses, but he would not be thwarted. The contract to build the causeway had been awarded to an Atlantic City, New Jersey firm. In the autumn of 1927, the president of the firm coolly informed Moses that its money had run out and it couldn't meet its payroll. Its laborers wouldn't work without pay, and work would have to stop unless $20,000 was found immediately. Moses drove to Albany, but Smith told him that every cent that could be squeezed out of the Highway Bureau budget, in fact, every cent that could be squeezed out of the budget of any department, had already been squeezed. More money would be available in the 1928 appropriations, of course, but they wouldn't be available until after January 1st. Promising to pay her back as soon as the appropriations came through, he did, Moses borrowed the $20,000 from his mother and paid the laborers himself. And they kept working. To the east of the portion of Jones Beach ceded to him by Hempstead Town, directly in the path of his proposed Ocean Parkway, lay 500 acres of meadowland owned by Oyster Bay Town and leased as a duck hunting preserve to a group of wealthy sportsmen headed by Solomon Guggenheim. When Moses appropriated the tract, the sportsmen obtained an injunction and served it on the contractor. But Moses met the contractor on the dredge, and, as Cleveland Rogers put it, "the legal papers somehow slipped off the deck into the swirling waters." When the hunters, in their fur-lined cloaks and escorted by their formidable legal advisers, arrived a few days later to shoot ducks, under full protection of the law, they found the meadow slashed through and filled in for the parkway. And always, day after day, summer and winter, Moses was out on the job, encouraging the men in the field. "People will work harder for you if they have a good time," he told the Morses, and he urged the laborers working on Jones Beach to go swimming during their lunch hour. Organizing softball games on the beach, he umpired them himself. Joking with the men, he made fun about his hat, and he told them what a great project they were building. "He had a gift for leading men," Shapiro recalls. "Those men idolized him. You'd see him walk up to a pickaxe gang that was tired and talk to them a while, and when he walked away, you could see those pickaxes swing faster. Hanging over Moses was the realization that every battle he won brought him closer to one there seemed no way of winning, and whose loss would mean that his dream would remain substantially incomplete. Every step he took to develop the land ceded him by Hempstead and Oyster Bay only brought him closer to the day when he must face up to the fact that the rest of Jones Beach was not his. Its eastern half, 9 miles long, 1,300 acres, still belonged to Babylon Township. Hutchinson and Hewitt might think the park he was laying out was already too big. He knew that, to serve the metropolitan area adequately, it would one day have to be far bigger, and the only place for expansion was Babylon's land. Moreover, if he didn't get that land before the Wantagh Causeway and Ocean Parkway, which would run up to its edge, made it accessible and immensely valuable, he knew he would never get it. And unless he got it, there was nothing to prevent Babylon from building a road to connect with the parkway and lining it with hot dog stands, gas stations, and tiny, ugly summer bungalows that would march right up to the edge of his great park and spoil forever its pristine beauty. Without Babylon's land, moreover, the Ocean Parkway would be only half as long as he wanted it, and it would be difficult to build a causeway and loop it back to mainland Long Island and the Southern State Parkway, because he had planned to cut the expense of that causeway by running it over Captree Island, a tongue of land at the eastern end, Babylon's end, of Jones Beach, which extended up toward the mainland. And since it was the eastern end of Jones Beach that almost touched Fire Island, without it, he would never be able to build a bridge from Jones Beach to Fire Island and thus enable the Ocean Parkway to continue along Fire Island to the Hamptons. Babylon's baymen had never forgiven him for his attempt to grab the town's sacred birthright. When Mary went shopping in town now, the tradesmen eyed her coldly. Sounding out the town board members again about a referendum, Moses found them still fully aware of their constituents' feelings. Moses tried threats. Many of the 1,000 Commission and Highway Bureau employees at Belmont Lake lived in Babylon, and therefore, Moses reminded the town's businessmen, much of the $400,000 monthly payroll was spent in the town. Doubtless, he said, more congenial headquarters for the state's work on Long Island can be found elsewhere. But the town was unmoved. The town board assured its constituents that there was not going to be any referendum, and without one, there was, under the state constitution, simply no way in which Moses could get the town's land. But Moses at last found a weak spot in Babylon's defenses. "I heard about it by the sheerest kind of accident," he told the author decades later. "I was thinking then about learning to drive. I never really did. And I was practicing one morning in a Model T in the driveway of this big estate out in Babylon owned by a guy named Willard Reed, whose father, who had been dead for years at this point, had been a Democratic county court judge in Suffolk, the only Democrat on the county court at the time Grover Cleveland was reelected. I saw Willard sitting on the porch rocking and drinking, and he called to me and said, 'Come on up and have a drink.' So we sat rocking away there and talking, and after a while he said, 'I hear you're having some trouble getting some land.' I said, 'Yes, we are.' And he said, 'The Babylon fellows don't want to cooperate?' And I said, 'No.' And he said, 'I remember a story my father told me once. You know, the whole question of the ownership of the bay bottom in Babylon Town came up a long time ago, and my father and another judge, a fellow in Amityville named Samuel Hildreth, were appointed to pass on it, and I think you'd be interested in what was found. You'll never find the decision in Riverhead, the county seat, where court records were kept, because the supervisors will have made sure it's missing. But Hildreth is alive.' I said, 'Tell me more, Willard.' He said, 'I think I've told you enough. You go and see this Hildreth fellow in Amityville, and you tell him I told him to talk to you.' I did, and Hildreth said that way back, in 1848 maybe, or 1856, two bills had been introduced in the legislature, See, before that, the underwater rights in the bay, the bay bottoms, had belonged to the state. But one of these two bills transferred the rights in Nassau County to the various towns in Nassau along the bay, and the other transferred the rights in Suffolk to the various Suffolk towns. Well, everyone on Long Island always just assumed that both of these had passed, but Hildreth told me that when he and Judge Reed had looked into it, they found that for some reason no one seemed to know, maybe just an oversight, only one passed, the Nassau one. I said, "Do I gather, then, that half the bay bottom belongs to the state? That Babylon doesn't own its bay bottom at all?" And I put all our bloodhounds on it, and I found those bills, and I found that Hildreth's story was true. Well, in all this time, the supervisors could have gotten the ownership of those lands transferred without any trouble, but I guess they had just decided to let things lie, and had kept issuing licenses to fish the bay bottoms when they had no right to. And so I blackjacked them. We told them that we'd trade them the Jones Beach land for the bay bottoms. Well, they didn't want to trade. They didn't want to give the land. But we told them that if they didn't, we'd let the people know that the town didn't own the bay bottom after all, that they'd been issuing licenses when they had no right to, that in all the years that had been available to remedy the mistake, they had never taken the simple step of obtaining title to the bay bottoms, that they had been negligent in their stewardship of the town's sacred heritage. To be convicted in the public eye of such negligence would have been even worse for them than to give away the barrier beach. The bay bottoms were much more important to the baymen. That was what their livelihood depended on. We blackjacked them, that's all. We threatened to tell, and we said, "Now, there's one way to adjust this thing." The way, the ultimatum that Moses presented to the town board, was to authorize the referendum and to issue a ruling that would give Moses a real chance of winning it. The voting would not be restricted to the town's tax-paying property owners, but would be open to anyone who lived there, including the several hundred state employees who had recently moved into apartments. This ruling would violate common sense and common practice. Generally, only property owners, a town's taxpayers, were allowed to vote in referenda involving the permanent removal of town property from tax rolls. But Moses did not leave the board members much choice. If the referendum passed, giving the beach land to the state, he told them, the state would in turn quietly give the bay bottoms to the town, and they could go right on issuing licenses. If the referendum passed, he would never tell their constituents about their negligence. And if it didn't pass, he would. To lull the town's baymen and property owners into overconfidence, the town board did not explode the bombshell about voting eligibility until 3 days before the election. Everything, in fact, was done so fast that the old-time residents never had a chance to organize. Without warning, at a routine meeting held on March 14, 1928, with few residents present, the town board, saying for the record that it was opposed to the beach ceding but felt the people's voice should be heard, authorized the referendum and scheduled it for the same day as party primary elections, April 3, 1928, less than 3 weeks away. "Judases!" Judge Cooper cried. The Park Commission flooded the local post office with mailings seeking to reassure Babylonians on points that were worrying them. One reassurance concerned a rumor that tolls would be charged on the Wantagh Causeway, that Babylonians would have to pay to use their own land. "Absolutely not," Moses said. In a letter he wrote to the leader, and which was printed by Cooper, who made a noticeable effort to give space to his foe's views, Moses promised, "The state causeway and boulevard will be free." Nonetheless, the judge could not conceive that, even with the voter eligibility ruling, the referendum would pass. No politician, he didn't understand certain other tactics the town board had used. He saw, for example, no significance in the fact that while the hours for voting in the primary were noon to 9 p.m., the hours for voting in the referendum ended at 6 p.m. None of the older residents of Babylon were prepared for election day. As they strolled to the polls, they suddenly noticed cars bearing state shields and crammed with men racing through the streets of the quiet village. They were park commission and DPW vehicles, carrying employees to vote. Undoubtedly, many of these employees were, under the suddenly relaxed eligibility ruling, eligible to vote. But opponents at the polls said that they recognized many as men who did not have even apartments in the town and were therefore ineligible. When, however, election inspectors tried to check their names against the list of eligible voters in the election registers with which election inspectors were customarily provided, they found that somehow the town board had neglected to provide registers this time, and the inspectors were unable to deny the state employees the right to vote. Realtors had cars out, too, rounding up voters known to favor the proposal and transporting them to the polls. But Moses' overconfident because hoodwinked, opponents did not have a single car in operation. In addition, many potential no voters, one estimate said 200, were confused by the fact that the polls remained open until 9. They showed up after 6, only to be told that while they could vote in the primary, voting in the referendum had been closed. The final tally showed that Babylon Town had ceded its portion of Jones Beach to the state by 7 votes. Wrote Cooper, "The verdict was nothing short of a crime, and the method by which it was obtained is scandalous." Moses issued a statement, too. He called the referendum results a vote of confidence in the Park Commission. The sands were running out on Al Smith's governorship. Moses' construction crews did not quit for the winter of 1927-28. Their grading machines pushed aside snow as well as earth as they smoothed the path for the Southern State Parkway. The Great South Bay froze solid. The men stretching the Jones Beach Causeway across it pitched tents on the ice and lived on it. Early in 1928, an astonished Hutchinson and Hewitt realized that the completion of the Southern State Parkway and Jones Beach Causeway, on which they had hinged the beginning of the Northern State, and which they had assumed was years, if not decades, away, was rapidly approaching. Frantically, they tried to delay it. In another year, Al Smith wouldn't be governor. Out of Moses' $4,500,000 1928 budget request, they slashed $626,000. But Smith found the money in the departmental budgets, and the construction crews kept working. Moses had not been given funds for his Long Island parks and parkways until the spring of 1926. By the end of the summer of 1928, in a period of less than 3 years, every foot of right-of-way for the Southern State Parkway was in his hands. A 7-mile stretch from near the New York City line to and around the Hempstead Reservoir was completed. Long rows of newly planted elms and maples lined it, and stone-faced bridges, every one different, were carrying crossroads over it so that nothing should interrupt the swift passage of its users. A second 7-mile stretch from the reservoir to Wantagh was completed except for the landscaping. A third 7-mile stretch from Wantagh to Babylon was graded and ready for paving. And the fill for the Wantagh Parkway had been laid, a pavement placed on top of the fill, and 3 of the 4 bridges that would carry the causeway across the bay completed. When Moses had become president of the Long Island State Park Commission on April 18, 1924, there had been one state park on Long Island, the almost worthless 200-acre tract on Fire Island. By the end of the summer of 1928, there were 14 parks, totaling 9,700 acres. Because 6,775 of those acres had been acquired from Hempstead, Oyster Bay, and Babylon towns, the U.S. Department of Commerce, New York City, and private individuals, as gifts, the Long Island parks had cost the state a total of about $1 million. At 1928 land values, they were worth more than $15 million. By the end of the summer of 1928, the watershed properties off Merrick Road had been filled with bathhouses, baseball fields, and bridle paths. Picnic areas with thousands of tables sat under their trees. Slides, swings, and jungle gyms spotted their clearings. Their lakes were decorated with floats, diving boards, sliding ponds, rowboats, and canoes. Heckscher State Park contained miles of paved roads for cars and dirt roads for horseback riders, acres of athletic fields, bathhouses holding 5,000 lockers, a boardwalk, a bathing pavilion with restaurants and snack bars, an inland canal for rowboating, and a marina at which sailboats could be moored. There were more bathhouses, more boardwalks, more playing fields, more snack bars, more picnic areas, more campsites at Sunken Meadow, Wildwood, Orient Beach, Montauk Point, and Hither Hills State Parks. On Jones Beach, 2 years before a desolate sandbar, there stood now, awaiting only the finishing touches that would be added in 1929, a bathhouse like a medieval castle, a water tower like the Campanile of Venice, a boardwalk, a restaurant and parking fields that held 10,000 cars each. In the history of public works in America, it is probable that never had so much been built so fast. During the summer of 1928, park-seeking families heading out of New York City began to feel Long Island open up to them. Week by week, word spread. At the beginning of the summer, the bathhouse at Valley Stream State Park contained 1,000 lockers. For a few weekends, these were sufficient. Then they were not. Another 1,000 lockers were added. Then another 1,000. And even so, by the end of the summer, thousands of would-be bathers were being turned away every weekend. By the end of the summer, attendance at Long Island's state parks had passed 500,000. New Yorkers knew who was primarily responsible for the boon they had been given. It would have been difficult for them not to know, for the press was turning Robert Moses into a hero. The lionization was on a scale as vast as the achievement. The 20s was an age for heroes, of course, and if 1927 was Lindbergh's year in the New York press, 1928 was Moses. Albert Einstein, who announced his theory of relativity in that year, was all but ignored in the city's 13 daily newspapers, but New York's reporters strove for new adjectives to describe the park builder, one writer concentrating on his physical attributes, tall, dark, muscular, and zealous, another on the mental, a powerful and nervous mind, a third on the moral, fearless, courageous, to describe Rhodes Scholar, Robert A. Moses, Robert B. Moses, most frequently Robert H. Moses. Reporters could not seem to reconcile themselves to his lack of a middle initial. Editorial writers chimed in. "His labors have been unwearied and successful," said the Times. "His energy and persistence, great." "He has been a faithful, earnest, and efficient incumbent," said the World. "He has done excellent work." Even the Herald Tribune was beginning to look on his works and find them good. And the praise, on front pages and editorial pages alike, continued day after day. If readers were reminded once during 1928 that Moses was serving the state without pay, they were reminded 100 times. Moses' lionization in the press had a practical benefit. It ensured that he would be allowed to finish the job he had started. No one would dare stop it now. The Long Island dream was safe. If the press erred in its description of Moses' achievements, it erred on the side of under, not overstatement. Long Island was only one segment of his state park system. The $14 million allocated for upstate parks in the bond issue was not nearly enough for the system he had in mind. Many of his hurried trips around the state were, therefore, attempts to persuade wealthy men who owned undeveloped land in scenic areas to give their land to the public. Luckily, many of these men were the old park patriots. The state had never bothered to buy a single foot of Lake George's hundreds of miles of shoreline, and cheap resorts and rooming houses were proliferating on its shores. Lumbermen had stripped the surrounding mountains of their softwood forests and were starting on the hardwoods. The denuded soil was being washed away by rains. But midway along the lake, a branch of water jutted out to the northwest, and of the 11,000 virgin acres on the tongue of land thus formed, most of it called Tongue Mountain, 6,000 were owned by a group of wealthy men who were also public-spirited. He persuaded them to donate their land to the state. The remaining 5,000 acres on the Tongue were owned by a family that was about to sell it to a lumbering company, but the family's attorney was Captain N. Taylor Phillips, a key figure in that stronghold of the Park Patriots, the American Scenic and Historic Preservation Society. Working through Phillips, Moses persuaded the family to lower its asking price from $40 per acre to $15, and when he bought the whole tract, he had succeeded in preserving for posterity a substantial part of the Lake George region for a total cost of $75,000. With the money he had saved, Moses preserved the historic battlefields at Fort Stanton and Oriskany, and, with Adolph Oakes's help, at Saratoga. He purchased the 10,692 still untouched acres of Whiteface Mountain, which he had so often climbed as a youth, thus ensuring that generations of youths who came after him would also be able to climb it. By the end of the summer of 1928, the scattered little historic reservations that Moses had inherited had been expanded into a system that included 70 parks, totaling more than 125,000 acres. And he had used $5 million of the bond issue to beat the lumbermen to great untouched tracts of the Adirondacks and Catskills and build up the state's forest preserve to 2,218,000 acres. When he had the parks, Moses built roads to link them with the nearest highways, and suddenly families in Rochester and Syracuse and Albany were visiting places they had hardly heard of before. Not only Letchworth Gorge and Watkins Glen, but Moonville Gorge, Rudd Pond, Roaring Brook, and Ore Pit. If they simply wanted to drive through these parks, there were gravel roads they could do that on. If they wanted to hike, there were hiking paths and nature trails through the woods. If they wanted to swim, there were paths down to beautiful hidden mountain lakes and bathhouses in which they could change into swimming outfits. If they wanted to picnic, there were picnic grounds of which every detail was designed to preserve the fresh, virgin quality of the woods. If they wanted to camp out, there were campsites designed with equal care, laid out next to cool mountain brooks. Newspapers in Rochester rhapsodized over Letchworth State Park, newspapers in Albany over Thatcher State Park, newspapers in Buffalo over the park on Devil's Island that overlooked Niagara Falls. But these newspapers had little interest in the Long Island parks, and New York City newspapers had little interest in the upstate parks. So no newspaper, no matter how enthusiastic it was over what editorial writers called Robert Moses' Great Park Program, comprehended the full extent of the program's magnitude, or the full extent of its greatness. Perhaps the most remarkable characteristic of these parks and parkways that were becoming physical realities in 1928 was that they were, for the most part, the parks and parkways he had proposed in the New York State Association park reports he had written in 1922 and 1923. They were located in the places he had proposed, and the details of their development, down to the facades of their bathhouses and how many lockers and parking spaces each would have, followed the plans Moses had made for them. Robert Moses had dreamed a dream immense in scope. By the end of the summer of 1928, the dream, all of the dream, even Jones Beach, which had seemed doomed to diminution in reality, was either reality or well on its way to becoming reality. Chapter 14. Changing. Lashed by his desire for the realization of his dreams, Bob Moses had changed even before he became president of the Long Island State Park Commission on April 18, 1924, from the idealist who put his faith in truth and reason to the pragmatist who put his faith in power. But the acquisition of power in his own name on that date, and his use of power thereafter, broadened the change, accelerated it, intensified it, raised it to an entirely new level. For once Bob Moses came into possession of power, it began to perform its harsh alchemy on his character, altering its contours, eating away at some traits, allowing others to enlarge. The potential for these changes had always been there, like a darker shadow on the edge of the bright gold of his idealism. With each small increase in the amount of power he possessed, the dark element in his nature had loomed larger, becoming prominent enough for sharp-eyed men to begin to notice it. Had not Reuben Lazarus said, "When Smith brought him up to Albany, he began to be, quite suddenly and quite noticeably, a lot more arrogant"? Such men concluded that Moses, even more than most other men, liked power in and for itself. Some of them suspected that if Moses ever obtained in substantial measure power of his own, the alteration in his character would become a transformation. But even sharp-eyed men could not be prepared for the extent of the transformation. For adulthood was, after all, only a part of the pattern of Moses' life, and they had not seen the other part of the pattern. They could not know, therefore, how far back in the overall pattern the dark thread ran. They could not know how inextricably it was knotted into the pattern's most central design. They had seen Moses' fingers drum impatiently on a table when someone dared to disagree with him, but they had never seen drumming impatiently another set of fingers. They had seen Bob Moses tilt back his head and look down his nose in the prosecutor's stance, but, not having known Moses in his boyhood, they couldn't know where the tilt came from. They may have known Bob Moses, but they did not know Bob Moses' mother. They did not know Bob Moses' grandmother, and therefore they could not know the origin or the depth of his susceptibility to the infection of power. They could not know that the susceptibility lay not in Albany, but in family, in heredity or upbringing or some combination of the two. He was Bella Moses' son, the one of her children most like her, the one in whom surfaced most strongly the mixed strain of passionate idealism and overweening arrogance that she had inherited from her parents, Granny and Bernard Cohen. When the idealism died, the arrogance was already well-rooted and strong. If it was given nourishment, it would expand, and power feeds arrogance. As Moses obtained power, therefore, the traits symptomatic of his arrogance became steadily more noticeable. The pattern's hue darkened. His mother had always displayed, as a Madison House trustee and as a wife, a conviction of her own infallibility, and a predisposition to impose her will on others, an unwillingness to listen to others, a burning impatience to see her solutions to problems implemented, to get things done. Moses' imagination seemed most easily fired, as his mother's had been, by physical problems and physical solutions, problems that could be solved by construction, by the shaping of concrete and steel. And the resemblance in traits between mother and son went beyond that. As a staffer at the Bureau of Municipal Research, he had displayed the same dogmatism and the same impatience. Bob Moses had wanted his own way, and he had wanted it when he wanted it. And now that he had power, he was going to see that he got it. He had never wanted to listen to people who disagreed with him. Now, in the main, he didn't have to. "When he talked to you," recalls Leonard W. Hall, then a state assemblyman, "he'd just tell you what he was going to do. If you disagreed with him and tried to explain your feelings, or even started asking questions, he would cut right in, slash at you, without answering the questions, making you feel stupid for asking. And if you were talking to him on the phone, he'd just hang up on you. I remember talking to him on the phone and disagreeing with him about something, and I was in the middle of a sentence, and the damn phone was slammed down." Moses had always displayed contempt for people he felt were considerably beneath him, the colored subject people of the British Empire, for example, or civil servants who hadn't attended Oxford or Cambridge. At the Municipal Civil Service Commission, his irritation at having to interrupt his work for public hearings indicated a tendency to feel that the public he was serving was beneath him, that its suggestions about its own destiny were not worth listening to. Now, that feeling about the public was intensified. when the governor's office received a letter making a suggestion about parks or criticizing one of the regional commissions, the letter was invariably referred by George Graves, Smith's secretary, to Moses for a suggested reply that could be sent back over the governor's signature. Now, more and more frequently, Moses would suggest that no one bother to reply at all. His contempt was not limited to the public. It included, apparently, most state legislators. If he wasn't hanging up on them in mid-sentence, he was treating them with extravagant disdain. They didn't dislike him just because politically he was cutting them to pieces, Hall recalls. They disliked him personally. He acted with a complete arrogance. He insulted those men to their face. Sniffing at the patronage possibilities at Jones Beach as though they were sea air, Senate Finance Committee Chairman Jeremiah F. Toomey of Brooklyn asked Moses to drop around for a chat before the Finance Committee hearings on a Jones Beach appropriation bill. According to Hall, to whom Toomey told the story, Toomey says, "Bob, it looks like there'll be a lot of jobs out there, and I was wondering if we could get a couple." Bob answers very softly, very gently, very politely, "What did you have in mind, Jerry?" he asks. Jerry mentions one job, and Moses says very softly, very politely, "Do you have anything else on your mind, Jerry?" Jerry, completely taken in, thinking that for once this fellow was going to be reasonable, mentions a couple of other jobs, and Moses says, "Do you have anything else on your mind, Jerry?" Jerry says, "Well, that's about all." And Moses says, "Jerry, you can take that bill and stick it up your ass." Moses had always been impatient. Most men didn't move fast enough for him. Now he could do something about it. The park philanthropists on the State Council of Parks didn't move fast enough for him. There were many reasons. For one thing, most of the regional commissions whose chairmen comprised the council were made up of men with a different philosophy of parks from his. This was understandable. They were, in the main, elderly men, men out of the days when parks had meant conservation rather than recreation. Even during the 1920s, of course, parks still meant conservation to most park experts. There wasn't one in the country who would lean as heavily as Moses to thinking of parks as baseball fields and tennis courts, rather than as glades and forests and hiking trails. The regional commissioners, men of the older era, had become interested in parks to preserve as much of nature's beauties as possible from a ruthless civilization. When they saw the developer's bulldozer imperiling a favorite piece of woodland, they purchased the woodland with their own money and presented it to the state, and when they realized that the state would not provide sufficient funds to preserve it as it should be preserved, they put up the money themselves, year after year, and they put up their time, too, spending weekends and vacations on inspection trips, often making needed repairs with their own hands. In drawing up their wills, they chose carefully the men they wanted to administer the properties after they were gone, and these men, too, felt that preserving the properties in the condition in which they had received them was a sacred trust. Proposals for huge parking fields, for restaurants, these seemed to them to conflict with the ideals they had sworn themselves to preserve. If the state now wanted to develop those parks, well, certainly some development was necessary. As long as it was done slowly and carefully, it could be worked out. But they wanted to make sure that the development did not destroy the natural qualities they treasured. There were other reasons, too, for Moses' impatience with the regional commissioners. At bottom, the philosophy of government on which they had been weaned emphasized the rights of the individual. They believed, therefore, that governmental power should be used with the utmost restraint. They were, frankly, dismayed by the way Moses had used entry and appropriation against Havemeyer and Macy, by the way he had threatened to use it against the North Shore Barons, and they didn't intend to use such techniques themselves, even if using slower techniques meant that parks and parkways in their areas wouldn't be acquired as fast as Moses wanted. A more important source of conflict in their dealings with Moses, however, had nothing to do with philosophy. It was simply that the old men wanted to remain in charge of the parks they loved. Moses had let them believe that they would remain in charge. He had given them no hint of his true purposes. For Moses had needed them. He had needed their prestige, their reputation, as strong with legislators as with the public, for uprightness